and unwise. A weak or incompetent defense lawyer would only screw up the case and give the appeals courts plenty to chew on for the next decade. He replied, "I'd probably go with Jake." Without hesitation, New said, "So would I. But let's not tell him about this conversation." "Of course not." Lowell got on well with Jake and did not want any friction. If Jake somehow learned that the DA and the judge had conspired to keep him on the clock, he would hold a grudge. Next, Lowell called Jake and found him at the office. The purpose of the call was not to break the news that he was stuck with Gamble till the bitter end, but something more professional. Lowell said, "Jake, just calling to let you know that I'm assembling the grand jury tomorrow afternoon at the courthouse." Jake was pleased, thought it was a courteous gesture, and said, "Thanks, Lowell. I'm sure it will be a brief meeting. Mind if I sit in?"
"You know that's not possible, Jake."
"Just kidding. Mind giving me a call when the indictment comes down?"
"You know I will."
Ozzie's chief investigator was his only investigator at the moment, and he wasn't really looking for another one. His name was Kirk Rady, a veteran of the department and a well-regarded officer. Ozzie could dig for the facts better than most sheriffs, and together with Rady, they handled all of the serious crimes in the county. At straight up 4 o'clock Monday afternoon, they walked into Jake's office and said hello to Portia at the front desk. She was professional, as always, and asked them to wait a moment. Though he was now doing battle with Jake, Ozzie was proud to see a smart and ambitious young black woman working in one of the law offices around the square. He knew Portia and her family, and he knew she planned to be the first black female lawyer in the county. And with Jake as her mentor and supporter, she would certainly succeed. She returned, and she waved them over to a door down the hall. They stepped inside, and the room was already occupied. Jake welcomed them with handshakes and then introduced the sheriff and Rady to Josie Gamble, Kira Gamble, and their minister, Charles McGarry. They were on one side of the table, and Jake offered Ozzie and Rady seats on the other side. Portia closed the door and sat beside Kira, facing Ozzie. Judging from the open legal pads, the half-empty coffee cups and water bottles, the scattered pens, and Jake's loosened tie, it was fairly obvious that the lawyer had already spent time with the witnesses. Ozzie had not seen Josie since his quick visit to the hospital the day after the murder, a week earlier. Jake had told him that her surgery had gone well, and she was mending as expected. Her left eye was still puffy, black and blue, and her left jaw was still swollen. Two band-aids were visible. She tried to be polite and smile, but it didn't work. After some awkward chit-chat, Jake punched a button on a tape recorder in the center of the table and said, "Do you mind if I record this?" Ozzie shrugged and said,
"It's your office."
"True, but it's your interview. I don't know if you routinely record these things."
"Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't," Rady said like an ass. "We don't normally talk to witnesses in lawyers' offices."
"Ozzie called me," Jake fired back, "asked me to arrange this interview. You can do it somewhere else if you like."
"We're fine," Ozzie said. "Record anything you want."
Jake spoke to the recorder, gave the date, place, and names of everyone in the room. When he finished, Ozzie said,
"Now I'd like to understand everybody's role here. We're officers investigating a crime. You two ladies are potential witnesses. And Pastor McGarry, what is your role?"
"I'm just the chauffeur," Charles said with a smile.
"That's nice." Ozzie looked at Jake and asked, "Should he be in the room?"
Jake shrugged and said, "That's your call, Ozzie. This is not my interview. I'm just making things happen."
"I'd feel better if you stepped outside," Ozzie said.
"No problem." Charles smiled and left the room.
"And what's your role here, Jake? You don't represent these ladies, do you?"
"Technically, no.
I have been appointed to represent Drew, not the family. However, if we assume there will be a trial one day, Josie and Carol will be important witnesses, perhaps called by the state, perhaps called by the defense. I may well be the defense lawyer. Their testimony might be crucial. Therefore, I have a real interest in what they tell you. Ozzie was not a lawyer and not about to argue trial strategy and criminal procedure with Jake Brigance.
Can we interrogate them without you?
No. I've already advised them not to cooperate unless I'm in the room. As you know, you can't make them talk. You can subpoena them to the stand at trial, but you can't make them talk right now. They're just potential witnesses. Jake's tone was more aggressive, his words sharper. The tension was rising considerably. Portia, taking notes, thought to herself, I can't wait to become a lawyer. Everyone took a deep breath. Ozzie flashed his best politician's smile and said,
Okay, let's get on with it.
Rady opened his notebook and gave Josie a smile, so drippy Jake wanted to slap him. He said,
First of all, Ms. Gamble, I'd like to ask if you were able to talk, and if so, for how long? I understand the surgery was only a few days ago.
Josie nodded nervously and said,
Thank you. I'm okay. The stitches and wires came out this morning, and I can talk a little.
Are you in pain?
Not too bad.
Are you taking medication for pain?
Just some ibuprofen.
Okay. Can we start with you and your background? That sort of thing.
Jake immediately interrupted with, Let's try this. We're working on what we hope to be a complete biographical sketch of the Gamble family. Birth dates, birthplaces, homes, addresses, marriages, employers, relatives, criminal records, the good, the bad, the ugly. Some of it they remember, some is not so clear. We need it for our side. Portia is in charge of it, and it has priority. When it is complete, we'll give you a copy. Full disclosure. You can read it, and if you then want to interrogate these witnesses again, we'll talk about it. This will save us at least an hour today, and there won't be any gaps. Fair enough? Rady and Ozzie exchanged looks, skeptical ones. Ozzie said,
We'll try it.
Rady flipped a page and said,
Okay, let's go back to Saturday night, March 24th, just over a week ago. Can you tell us what happened? Tell us your story about that night?
Josie took a sip of water through a straw and glanced nervously at Jake, who had given her strict instructions about what to cover and what to leave alone. She began with,
Well, it was late, and Stu wasn't home.
As instructed, she spoke slowly and seemed to struggle with each word. The swelling didn't help. She described what it was like to wait and wait while expecting the worst. She was downstairs. The kids were upstairs in their bedrooms, awake, waiting, afraid. Stu finally came home around 2, very drunk, belligerent as usual, and they had a fight. She got hit and woke up in the hospital.
You said drunk as usual. Did Stu often come home drunk?
Yes. He was out of control. We had lived there about a year, and his drinking was a real problem.
Do you know where he had been that night?
No. He would never tell me that.
But you knew he hung out in bars and such, right?
Oh, yes. I went with him a few times in the earlier days, but I stopped because he would get in fights.
Rady was careful here, because the sheriff's department was still looking for paperwork. On 2 occasions, Josie had called the dispatcher and said she was being beaten by Stuart Kofer. But when the deputy showed up, she refused to press charges. The reports were filed, and then they disappeared. Jake would probably learn about this down the road, and Ozzie did not look forward to those questions. Missing paperwork? A cover-up? A sheriff's department looking the other way while one of its own spiraled out of control? Jake would make them bleed in the courtroom. Didn't you meet in a bar?
We did.
Around here?
No, it was a club up around Holly Springs.
Rady paused and struggled with his notes. The wrong question could provoke the wrath of Jake.
So, you don't remember the shooting?
No.
She shook her head and stared at the table.
Didn't hear a thing?
No.
Have you talked to your son since the shooting?
She took a deep breath and fought to keep her composure.
We spoke by phone last night. The first time. He's down in Whitfield, but you probably know that. Said the sheriff here drove him down on Friday.
How's he doing, if I may ask?
She shrugged and looked away. Jake helped out with, just so you'll know, I've talked to the counselors down there. Josie and Kira will go to Whitfield tomorrow. The preacher is taking them. And they'll see Drew and meet with the people who are treating him. It seems to be very important that they, the doctors, talk to the family and get the background. Ozzie and Rady nodded their approval. Rady flipped a page and read some of his notes.
Did Stu ever take Drew hunting?
Josie shook her head.
He took him fishing once, but it didn't go well.
A long pause. No details were coming.
What happened? Rady asked.
Drew was using one of Stu's rods, and he hooked a big fish that bit hard and ran and yanked the rod out of Drew's hands. It was gone. Stu had been drinking beers, and he flew hot, hit Drew, made him cry. That was the only fishing trip.
Did he take him hunting?
No. You gotta understand that Stu didn't want my kids to begin with. And the longer they stayed, the more he resented them. The whole situation was slowly blowing up. His drinking, my kids, fights over money. The kids were begging me to leave, but we had no place to go.
To your knowledge, had Drew ever fired a gun before?
She paused and caught her breath.
Yeah. One time, Stu took him out behind a barn, and they shot at targets. I don't know which gun they used. Stu had a bunch of them, you know? It didn't work out too well, because Drew was afraid of guns and couldn't hit anything, and Stu laughed at him.
You said he hit Drew. Did that happen more than once?
Josie glared at Rady and said,
Sir, it happened all the time. He hit all of us.
Jake leaned forward and said, We're not going into the physical abuse today, guys. There was a lot of it, and we'll detail it in our summary. It might be a factor in a trial, or it might not be. But as for now, we're skipping it. Fine with Ozzie. What was offered as proof at trial was the business of the district attorney, not the sheriff. But what a messy trial it could be. He said,
Look, since this is the first of these visits, let's just hit the high points and move on. We've established that you, Josie, were unconscious when the shooting occurred. We didn't know that. Now we do. So we're making progress. We'll ask Kira a few questions. And that'll be it, all right?
Sounds good, Jake said. Rady produced another sappy smile and said to Kira,
Okay, miss, could you tell us your story? What happened that night?
Her story was much more involved because she remembered all of it. The dread of another Saturday night, the waiting until late, the sweep of the headlights, the commotion in the kitchen, the yelling, the sound of flesh hitting flesh, the horror of hearing his stumbling boots coming up the stairs, his heaving, his slurred words, his goofy calling of her name, their jerry-rigged brace against the door, the rattling of the doorknob, The banging, the yelling, the unrestrained fear as brother and sister clung to each other. Then the silence. The sounds of his retreat down the stairs. And worst of all, nothing from their mother. They knew he had killed her. For an eternity, the house was silent. And with each passing minute, they knew their mother was dead. Otherwise, she would be trying to protect them. Kira managed to narrate the story while wiping away tears and not slowing down. She had tissues in both hands and spoke with emotion, but her voice did not crack. Jake still had no plans to be anywhere near the trial of Drew Gamble, but the courtroom lawyer in him could not help but assess her as a witness. He was impressed with her toughness, her maturity, her determination. Though 2 years younger, she seemed to be years ahead of her brother. But the part about her dead mother slowed her to the point of needing water. She took a drink from a bottle, wiped her cheeks, gave Rady a hard look, and continued. They found her on the kitchen floor, non-responsive, no pulse, and they wept. Drew eventually called the dispatcher. Hours seemed to pass. He closed the bedroom door. She heard a shot. Rady asked, "So did you see Stu on the bed before he was shot?"
"No."
As per Jake, answers in response to a direct question should be kept short.
"Did you see Drew with a gun?"
"No."
"Did Drew say anything to you after you heard the shot?"
Jake was quick to interrupt. "Don't answer that. It could be hearsay and inadmissible in court. I'm sure we'll fight over it later, but not now." Ozzie had heard enough, both from the witnesses and from the lawyer. He abruptly stood and said, "That's all we need. Thank you for your time, ladies. Jake, we'll be in touch. Or not. I'm sure you'll hear from the district attorney in the near future." Jake stood as they left the room. He sat down when they were gone, and Portia closed the door. Josie asked,
"How'd we do?"
"You were great."
Chapter 16. The long day began at sunrise when Charles McGarry swept his headlights across the rear of his little country church. Lights were on in the kitchen, and he knew that Josie and Kira were wide awake and ready to go. He met them at the door, exchanged hurried greetings because they had hours to talk in the car, and locked the church behind them. Kira folded her long legs into the rear of the small McGarry family car, and Josie got herself situated in the front passenger seat. Charles pointed to the digital clock on the dash and said, 6:46. Remember the time. It's supposed to take 3 hours. His wife Meg had planned to join them, but truthfully, the car was too small for four people sitting shoulder to shoulder for a long ride. And a grandmother who promised to babysit had fallen ill. "Meg sent some sausage biscuits," he said, "in that bag back there."
"I'm going to be sick,"
Kira said.
"She's not feeling well,"
Josie said.
"I'm going to be sick, Mom,"
she said again. "Serious?" he asked.
"Pull over, quick."
They had gone less than half a mile. The church was almost visible behind them. Charles hit the brakes and stopped on the shoulder. Josie was already opening the door and pulling her daughter out. She vomited in a ditch and retched for a few minutes while Charles watched for headlights and tried not to listen. She cried and apologized to her mother, and they discussed something. Both were crying when they got back in the car, and for a long time, nothing was said. Finally, Josie offered a fake laugh and said,
"She's always had a problem with car sickness. Never seen anything like it. Kid can chuck it before I start the engine."
"You okay back there?" Charles asked over his shoulder.
"I'm fine,"
she mumbled, head back, eyes closed, arms across her stomach.
"How about some music?"
he asked.
"Sure,"
Josie said.
"You like gospel?"
Not really, she thought.
"How about it, Kira? You want to listen to some gospel music?
No.
Charles turned on the radio and tuned in to the country station out of Clanton. They skirted around the edge of town and found the main highway south. At 7, the news came on, weather first, then a report that the district attorney, Lowell Dyer, had confirmed that the Ford County grand jury would meet later in the day to work on its docket. And yes, the murder of Officer Stuart Cofer would be discussed. Charles reached over and turned off the radio. The car sickness struck again a few miles south of Clanton, this time on a highway busy with early morning traffic. Charles turned the car into someone's gravel drive, and Kira jumped out, barely averting a mess. Once she was back in the car, Josie said,
"It might be the smell of those biscuits. Could we put them in the trunk?"
Charles really wanted one for breakfast, but he decided not to take chances. He unbuckled, grabbed the bag off the back seat, opened the trunk, and put away their breakfast. Meg had been up at 5 to fry the sausage and thaw the frozen biscuits. On the road again, Charles glanced in his mirror every minute or so. Kira was pale, and her forehead was wet. Her eyes were closed, and she was trying to nap. Josie felt the uneasiness and knew that Charles was worrying about her daughter. To change the subject, she said,
"We talked to Drew last night. Thanks for allowing us to use the church phone."
"No problem. How's he doing?"
"I don't know. It's hard to say. He's in a better place, a small room with a cellmate, a kid who's 17, but a good boy so far. And Drew says the doctors are nice and seem really concerned about him. They put him on a drug, an antidepressant, and he says he's feeling better. He met with 2 different doctors yesterday, and they just asked him a bunch of questions in general."
"Any idea how long they'll keep him?"
"No, that has not been discussed so far. But he'd rather stay where he is than go back to the jail in Clanton. Jake says there's no way to get him out. Says no judge in the state would set a bond in a case like this."
"I'm sure Jake knows what he's talking about."
"We like Jake a lot. Do you know him well?"
"No. Remember, Josie, I'm new around here, just like you. I grew up over in Lee County."
"Yeah, that's right. Gotta tell you, it sure is a comfort having a guy like Jake as our lawyer. Are we supposed to pay him?"
"I don't think so. Isn't he appointed by the court?"
She nodded and mumbled something, as if she suddenly remembered another story. Kira managed to curl herself into a ball in the rear seat and take a nap. After a few miles, Josie turned to look at her and whispered,
"Hey, baby, you okay?"
Kira did not respond. It took an hour to get processed and directed to one building and then another, where they were herded into a waiting room where 2 guards wore guns on their hips. One of them with a clipboard emerged from the back and approached Charles. She managed a forced smile and asked,
"Are you here to see Drew Gamble?"
Charles pointed to Josie and Kira and said,
"They are. They're his family. Please follow me."
Every door had a buzzer that clicked, and as they moved deeper into the labyrinth, the halls became wider and cleaner. They stopped at a metal door with no window, and the guard said,
"I'm sorry, but it's family only."
"Fine with me," Charles said. He hardly knew Drew and was not eager to spend the next hour with him. Josie and Kira walked inside and found Drew seated in the small windowless room. All 3 grabbed each other with fierce embraces and began crying. Charles watched from the open door and felt enormous pity for them. The guard backed out, closed the door, and said,
"A counselor would like to speak to you."
"Sure." What else was he supposed to say? The counselor was standing in the door of a small cluttered office in yet another wing. She introduced herself as Dr. Sadie Weaver and said she was borrowing the office for the moment. They wedged themselves inside and she closed the door.
"And you're their minister?"
she began, with no thought of preliminary chatter. She gave every impression of being incredibly busy.
"Well, sort of. Let's say yes, okay. They're not officially members of my church, but we've sort of adopted them. They have no place else to go, no family in the area. We spent a few hours with Drew yesterday. Sounds like the family has had a rough time of it. He's never seen his father. I've spoken with their lawyer, Mr. Brigance, and with Dr. Christina Rooker in Tupelo. She saw Drew last Thursday and asked the court to commit him for evaluation. So I know some of the background. Where are they living?"
"In our church. They're safe and well-fed."
"Bless you. Sounds like the mother and sister are being cared for. I, of course, am more concerned with Drew. We'll spend this afternoon and tomorrow with him and his mother and sister. I assume you're their driver?"
"I am."
"How long can you leave them here?"
"I'm flexible. I have no plans."
"Good. Leave them here for 24 hours. Pick them up tomorrow."
"Okay. How long will you keep Drew?"
"It's hard to say. Weeks, not months. As a general rule, they're better off here than in a county jail."
"Right. Keep him as long as you can. Things are pretty tense in Ford County."
"I understand."
Charles made his way out of the building and eventually found his car. He cleared the checkpoints and by noon was back on the road, headed north. At a convenience store, he bought a soft drink, retrieved his biscuits from the trunk, and enjoyed the solitude with his brunch and gospel music. The Ford County grand jury met twice a month. Its docket was typically mundane. Petty drug busts, car thefts, a knifing or two at the clubs and tonks. The last killing had been a Wild West-style shootout after a black funeral where two warring families squared off and began firing. One man was killed, but it was impossible to determine who shot who. The grand jury indicted the most likely suspect for manslaughter, and his case was still pending, with no one really pushing it. He was free on bond. There were 18 members of the grand jury, all registered voters from the county, and they had been impaneled by Judge Noose 2 months earlier. They met in the small courtroom down the hall from the main one, and their meetings were private. No spectators, no press. None of the usual bored courthouse gang looking for a little drama. Typically, for the first month or so, the honor of being a member of the grand jury was worth bragging about. But after a few sessions, the job grew tedious. They heard only one side of the story, the one presented by law enforcement, and there was almost never any dissent. So far, they had not failed to issue any of the indictments being sought. Whether they realized it or not, they had quickly become little more than a rubber stamp for the police and prosecutors. A special session was unusual, and by the time they gathered on Tuesday afternoon, April 3rd, each of the 16 present knew exactly why they had been summoned. Two were absent, but there was easily a quorum. Lowell Dyer welcomed them back, thanked them again as if they had a choice, and explained that they had a very serious matter in front of them. He gave the basics of the Cofer murder and asked Sheriff Walls to sit in the witness seat at the end of the table. Ozzie was sworn to tell the truth and began his narrative, time and date, cast of characters, 911 call, the scene when Chief Deputy Moss Jr. Tatum first arrived. He described the bedroom and the bloody mattress, and passed around enlarged color photos of Stewart with part of his head blown off. Several of the grand jurors took a look, reacted, then looked away. The service pistol was beside the body. The cause of death was fairly obvious. A single shot to the head, close range.
"The boy was in the living room and told Deputy Tatum that Stewart Cofer was in his bedroom and he thought he was dead. Tatum went to the bedroom, saw the body, and asked the boy, Drew, what happened, but got no answer. The girl, Kira, was in the kitchen, and when Tatum asked her what happened, she said, Drew shot him. It's an open and shut case."
Dyer was pacing around the room and stopped to say, "Thank you, Sheriff. Any questions?" The room was silent as the grand jurors felt the weight of such an awful crime. Finally, Miss Tabitha Green from Caraway raised her hand and asked Ozzy,
"How old are these children?"
"The boy Drew is 16. His sister Kira is 14.
"And were they home by themselves?"
"No, their mother was with them."
"And who's their mother?"
"Josie Gamble."
"What's her relationship with the deceased?"
"Girlfriend."
"Forgive me, Sheriff, but you're not exactly forthcoming with all the facts here. I feel like I'm prying stuff out of you, and that makes me very suspicious."
Miss Tabitha looked around as she spoke, looking for support. So far, there was none. Ozzy glanced at Dyer as if he might need some help. He said, "Josie Gamble is the mother, and she and her two children have been living with Stuart Kofa for about a year."
"Thank you. And where was Miss Gamble when the shooting took place?"
"In the kitchen."
"Doing what?"
"Well, according to the story, she was unconscious. When Stuart Kofa came home that night, they had a fight, and evidently Josie got injured and was unconscious."
"He knocked her unconscious?"
"That seems to be what happened."
"Well, Sheriff, why didn't you tell us that? What are you trying to hide from us?"
"Nothing. Nothing at all. Stuart Kofa was shot and killed by Drew Gamble, plain and simple, and we're here to get him indicted for it."
"Understood. But we're not a bunch of kindergartners. You want us to indict a person for capital murder, and that, of course, could mean the gas chamber. Don't you think it's only natural that we might want all the facts?"
"I guess so."
"We're not guessing, Sheriff. This happened at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning. Is it safe to assume that Stuart Kofa was not exactly sober when he came home and beat his girlfriend?"
Ozzy squirmed and looked about as guilty as an innocent man could look. He glanced at Dyer again and said,
"Yes, it is safe to assume that."
To Miss Tabitha's rescue came Mr. Norman Brewer, a retired barber who lived in an old section of Clanton.
"How drunk was he?" he asked.
A loaded question. If he had simply asked, "Was he drunk?" Ozzy could have simply answered yes, while avoiding the ugly details.
"He was quite intoxicated," he said.
Mr. Brewer said,
"So, he came home quite drunk, as you say, and he punched her, knocked her out cold, then the suspect shot him. Is that what happened, Sheriff?"
"Basically, yes."
"Basically. Did I get something wrong?"
"No, sir."
"Did he physically abuse the children?"
"They did not report that at the time."
"What condition was Kofa in when he got shot?"
"Well, we believe he was lying on his bed asleep. Evidently, there was no struggle with Drew."
"Where was the gun?"
"We don't know exactly."
Mr. Richard Bland from down in Lake Village said,
"So, Sheriff, it looks like Mr. Kofa was passed out drunk on his bed and was not awake when the kid shot him. Is that right?"
"We don't know if Stu was awake or asleep when he was shot. No, sir."
Lowell didn't like the direction of the questioning and said,
"I'd like to remind you that the condition of either the deceased or the defendant is not at issue for this grand jury. Claims of self-defense or insanity or whatever might be raised by the defense lawyers, but they are a matter for the trial jury to consider, not you."
"They're already claiming insanity from what I hear," said Mr. Bland.
"Maybe so, but what you hear on the street is not important inside this room,"
Lowell said in a lecturing tone.
"We're just dealing with the facts here. Any more questions?"
Miss Tabitha asked him,
"Have you had a capital murder indictment before, Lowell? This is certainly the first one for us."
"I have not, and I'm grateful for that."
"It just seems so routine," she said, "like all the other cases we process in here. Present a few facts, the bare necessities, limit the discussion, and we vote. We just rubber stamp whatever you want. But this is something else. This is the first step in a case that could send a man or a kid to death row at Parchment. It all seems too easy, too sudden to me. Anybody else feel this way?
She looked around but found little support. Dyer said, "I understand, Miss Green. What else would you like to know? This is a simple case. You've seen the dead body. We have the murder weapon. Besides the victim, there were three other people in the house at the scene. One was unconscious. One was a 16-year-old boy whose fingerprints were found on the murder weapon. The third person, his sister, told Deputy Tatum that her brother shot Stuart Kofa. That's it. Plain and simple." Miss Tabitha took a deep breath and fell back into her chair. Lowell waited and gave them plenty of time to think. Finally, he said, "Thank you, Sheriff." Without a word, Ozzie stood and left the room. Benny Hamm looked across the table at Miss Tabitha and asked,
"What's the problem? There's plenty of proof. What else do you want to do?"
"Oh, nothing. It just seems so fast, you know?"
Lowell said, "Well, Miss Tabitha, I assure you there'll be plenty of time to hash out all the issues in this case. After I file the indictment, my office will investigate and prepare for a full-blown trial. The defense will do the same. Judge Noose will insist on a speedy trial, and before long, you and everyone else on this grand jury can show up in the main courtroom down the hall and see how it goes." Benny Hamm said, "Let's vote."
"Let's do it,"
someone said. Miss Tabitha said,
"Oh, I'll vote to indict. It just seems too perfunctory. Know what I mean?"
All 16 voted, and the indictment was unanimously returned. Chapter 17. Tensions at the coffee shop were lessened considerably when the deputies found another breakfast spot. For years, Marshall Prather, Mike Nesbitt, and other assorted deputies would arrive early to eat biscuits and stir up the gossip, but not every morning. They had other favorite spots, and their shifts changed so their routines varied. Jake, though, had been there 6 mornings a week for years, and he had always enjoyed mixing it up with the deputies. But they were boycotting him now. When it became apparent that Jake had no plans to alter his ritual, they went elsewhere, which was fine with Jake. He did not enjoy the forced pleasantries, the strained looks, the feeling that things were not the same. They had lost a comrade, and Jake was now on the other side. He tried to convince himself it went with the territory. He almost believed that one day, not too far away, the gamble case would be behind them, and he and Ozzie and his men would be pals again. But the rift bothered him greatly, and he could not shake it. Dell kept him abreast of the latest rumblings. Without giving names, she would report that yesterday's lunch crowd was all abuzz with the coming indictment and questions about when and where the trial might be. Or that after Jake left that morning, a couple of farmers got pretty loud in their criticisms of Judge Noose and the system, and Jake in particular. Or that three ladies she hadn't seen in years sat by the window for an early lunch and talked quietly about Janet Kofer and her nervous breakdown. There was a palpable fear that Jake Brigance was about to pull another insanity stunt and get the boy off. And on it went. Dell heard everything, remembered everything, and relayed some of it to Jake when he stopped by late in the day and the cafe was empty. She was worried about him and his growing unpopularity. The morning after the indictment, Jake arrived at 6 and joined the usual crowd of farmers, cops, some factory workers, mostly men who rose early and punched in. Jake was about the only white collar who was a regular, and for this, he was admired. He often dispensed free legal advice and commented on Supreme Court rulings and other oddities, and he laughed along with the crooked lawyer jokes. Across the square at the tea shop, the white collars gathered later in the morning to discuss golf, national politics, and the stock market. At the coffee shop, they talked about fishing, football, and local crime, what little there was of it. After the good mornings, a friend said, "You seen this?" He held up a copy of the Ford County Times. It was published every Wednesday and had managed to catch the late-breaking story from Tuesday afternoon. A bold headline screamed, "Gamble indicted for capital murder." "Surprise, surprise," Jake said. However, Lowell Dyer had called him last night to confirm the news. Dell appeared with a coffee pot and filled his cup. "Good morning, sweetheart," Jake said.
"Keep your hands to yourself," she shot back, and scooted away.
There were a dozen regulars in already, and by 6:15 the cafe would be packed. Jake sipped his coffee and reread the front page story and learned nothing new. The reporter, Dumas Lee, had called his office late yesterday afternoon, fishing around for comments, but got none from Portia. Mr. Brigance, she explained, was in court.
"Your name is not mentioned," Dell said. "Already checked."
"Darn. I need the publicity." Jake folded the newspaper and handed it back. Bill West, a foreman at the shoe factory, arrived and fell into his usual chair. They talked about the weather for 5 minutes as they waited on breakfast. It finally arrived, and Jake asked Dell, "What took so long?"
"The chef's lazy. You want to discuss it with her?"
The chef was a large, rowdy woman with a short temper and the habit of throwing spatulas. They kept her in the back for a reason. As Jake was shaking Tabasco sauce on his grits, West said,
"I almost got in a fight about you yesterday. Guy I worked with said he'd heard that you were bragging about having that boy out by his 18th birthday."
"Did you punch him?"
"No, he's quite a bit bigger."
"He's also quite stupid."
"That's exactly what I called him. I said that, first of all, Jake doesn't go around popping off like that, and second, you wouldn't try to game the system for a cop killer."
"Thanks."
"Would you?"
Jake spread strawberry jam on his wheat toast and took a bite. He chewed and said, "No, I wouldn't. I'm still trying to get rid of the case." Bill said,
"That's what I keep hearing from you, Jake. But you're still on the case, right?"
"Yes, afraid so." A crane operator named Vance walked by the table, stopped, and stared at Jake. He pointed a finger and said loudly,
"They gonna fry that boy's ass, Jake, regardless of what you try to do."
"Well, good morning, Vance," Jake said. Heads were turning in the direction of the noise. "How's the family?" Vance was a once-a-week guy and was fairly well-known at the cafe.
"Don't get smart with me. You got no business in court with that boy."
"That falls in the category of someone else's business, Vance. You take care of yours, I'll take care of mine."
"A dead officer is everybody's business, Jake. You pull a fast one and get him off on one of those technicalities, and there'll be hell to pay around here."
"Is that a threat?"
"No, sir. It's a promise."
Dell walked in front of Vance and hissed,
"Sit down or get out."
He rumbled back to his table, and for a few minutes the cafe was quieter. Bill West finally said,
"I suppose you're getting a lot of that these days."
Jake replied, "Oh yeah, but it's just part of the job. Since when are lawyers admired by all?" He loved the office at 7 a.m., before the day began, and the phone started ringing, before Portia arrived at 8 with a list of things for him to do and questions to answer, before Lucian rolled in mid-morning and stomped upstairs with his cup of coffee to disrupt whatever Jake was doing. He turned on the lights downstairs and checked each room, then went to the kitchen to brew the first pot. He went upstairs to his office and took off his jacket. In the middle of his desk was a 2-page motion Portia had prepared the day before. It was a request by the defense to transfer Drew Gamble's case to youth court, and when filed, it would set off another round of nasty gossip. The motion was a formality, and Noose had already promised to deny it. But as the defense lawyer of record, Jake had no choice. If the motion were granted, an impossibility, the murder charge would be tried before the youth court judge with no jury. When found guilty, Drew would be sent to a juvenile facility somewhere in the state and kept there until his 18th birthday, when the court surrendered jurisdiction. At that point, there was no procedural mechanism to allow the circuit court to assume jurisdiction. In other words, Drew would be allowed to go free after less than 2 years behind bars. There was nothing fair about this law, but Jake couldn't change it. And it was precisely for this reason that Noose would keep the case. Jake could not imagine the backlash if his client walked after serving such a short sentence, and frankly, he was not in favor of it. He knew, though, that Noose would protect him while at the same time protecting the integrity of the system. Portia had attached a 4-page brief that Jake read with admiration. As always, she was thorough and discussed a dozen prior cases involving minors, one reaching back to the 1950s. She argued persuasively that minors are not as mature as adults and do not possess the same decision-making skills and so on. However, each case she cited had ended with the same result. The minor was kept in circuit court. Mississippi had a long history of putting minors on trial for serious crimes. It was an admirable effort. Jake edited the motion and brief, and when Portia arrived, they discussed the changes. At 9, he walked across the street and filed the paperwork. The assistant clerk accepted it without comment, and Jake left without his customary flirting. Even the clerk's office seemed a bit cooler these days. Harry Rex could always find a reason to get out of town on business, away from the turmoil of his contentious divorce practice and away from his quarrelsome wife. He sneaked out the rear door of his office late in the afternoon and enjoyed the long, quiet drive to Jackson. He went to Hal and Mal's, his favorite restaurant, took a table in a corner, ordered a beer, and began waiting. 10 minutes later, he ordered another one. During his law school days at Ole Miss, he had downed many beers with Dobie Pittman, a wild man from the coast who had finished first in their class and chose the big firm route in Jackson. He was now a partner in a 50-lawyer group that did well representing insurance companies in major damage cases. Pittman was not involved with Smallwood, but his firm was lead counsel. Another partner, Sean Gilder, had drawn the case. A month earlier, over beers in the same restaurant, Pittman had whispered to his old drinking buddy that the railroad might approach Jake and discuss the possibility of a settlement. The case was frightening for both sides. 4 people had been killed at a bad crossing poorly maintained by the railroad. There would be enormous sympathy for the Smallwoods, and Jake had impressed the defense with his aggressiveness and demands for a trial. He had shown no reluctance in ramming through discovery and running to Noose when he thought the defense was stalling. He and Harry Rex had hired 2 top railroad crossing experts, plus an economist who would tell the jury that the 4 lost lives were worth millions. The railroad's biggest fear, according to Bar Talk from Dobie, was that Jake was hungry and craving another big courtroom win. On the other hand, the defense was confident that it could whittle away at the sympathy and prove the obvious, that Taylor Smallwood had crashed into the 14th boxcar without touching his brakes. Both sides could lose big or win big. A settlement was the safest route for both. Harry Rex damn sure wanted a settlement. Litigation was expensive, and he and Jake had borrowed, so far, $55,000 from Security Bank to finance the lawsuit. More expenses were likely. Neither lawyer on the plaintiff's side had that kind of money lying around. Of course, Pittman knew nothing about the loan. No one did, except for the banker and Carla Brigance. Harry Rex told his wife, his fourth one, nothing about his business. Dobie arrived 30 minutes late and didn't apologize. Harry Rex wasn't concerned with his tardiness. They drank a beer, ordered red beans and rice, and commented on the looks of some young ladies nearby. Then they got around to their jobs. Dobie had never understood his friend's desire to specialize in divorces in a podunk town like Clanton, and Harry Rex was repulsed by the grind and politics of a big firm in downtown Jackson. But both were fed up with the law and wanted out. Most of their lawyer friends felt the same way. Their orders arrived, and they were starving. After a few bites, Dobie said, "Looks like your boy has got himself in a mess up there." Harry Rex knew it was coming and said, "He'll be all right once he gets rid of the case." "That's not what I hear." "Okay, Pitt, just go ahead and tell me what Walter Sullivan has relayed to you boys from the mean streets of Clanton. He probably calls down here every day with the latest courthouse gossip, half of which he makes up to begin with. He has never been a proven source for breaking news. I know far more, and I'll correct his mistakes." Dobie laughed and shoveled in a chunk of andouille sausage. He wiped his mouth with a napkin and took a drink. "I don't talk to him, you know. Not my case. So I don't know much. What I hear comes from one of the paralegals working down the hall. Gilda keeps a lid on his files around the office." "Got it. So what's the buzz?" "That Brigance has got the town pretty upset because he's going the insanity route. The boy's already at Whitfield." "Not true. He's at Whitfield, okay. But just for an initial evaluation, that's all. Insanity might be an issue down the road at trial, but Jake won't be involved." "Well, he's involved right now. Gilda and his gang are thinking that Jake might have trouble picking himself the right jury in the railroad case." "So, the railroad's backing off settlement?" "Looks like it. And they're in no hurry to go to trial. They're going into a serious delay mode, hoping Brigance gets stuck with the kid. The murder trial could get ugly." "Delay? My gosh, I've never heard of such from a defense firm. It's one of our many specialties. But here's the problem, Pitt. Judge Noose controls his docket with an iron fist. And right now, he owes Jake a big one. If Jake wants a trial real soon, then it's going to happen." Dobie worked on his food for a moment, then washed it down. "Does Jake have a number?" "$2 million, Harry Rex said with a mouthful and no hesitation. Like a seasoned defense lawyer, Dobie grimaced as if it were $2 billion. Both men ate in silence and thought about the numbers. The contract Harry Rex negotiated with the Smallwood relatives gave him 1/3 if the case was settled and 40% if it went to trial. He and Jake had agreed to equally split the fee. Over beans and beers, the math was easy. It would be the biggest settlement in the history of Ford County, and it was sorely needed by both lawyers for the plaintiffs. Harry Rex was not yet spending the money, but he was certainly dreaming of it. Everything Jake owned was mortgaged. Plus, there was the business of that bank loan for litigation expenses.
"How much insurance coverage?"
Harry Rex asked with a smile. Dobie smiled back and said, "I can't answer that. Plenty."
"Figures. He's going to ask the jury for a lot more than $2 million.
But it's Ford County, a place that's never seen a $1 million verdict."
"There's always the first time, Pitt. I'll bet we can find 12 people who haven't heard about the murder."
Dobie laughed, and Harry Rex was forced to do the same.
Hell, Harry Rex, you can't find two people who don't know about it.
Maybe, but we'll do our research. Noose will give us plenty of time to pick a jury.
I'm sure he will. Look, Harry Rex, I want you to get some big bucks, some of that dirty insurance money, okay? A nice settlement that'll take the pressure off. But to do so, Brigance has got to get rid of that kid. Right now, that case is a liability, at least in the minds of Sean Gilder and Walter Sullivan.
We're working on it.
Chapter 18. It was well known that the law business peaked at noon each Friday and then shut down. The lawyers who normally clogged the halls of the courthouse vanished after lunch. Most of them fibbed to their secretaries and left for the country stores, where they bought cold beer and roamed the back roads in blessed solitude. With the phone silent and the bosses gone, the secretaries often sneaked away too. No self-respecting judge would be caught dead in a robe on Friday afternoon. Most went fishing or played golf. The clerks, who generally milled about laden with important documents, ran errands across the street and didn't come back, instead easing away to beauty parlors and grocery stores. By mid-afternoon, the wheels of justice ground to a halt. Jake was planning to call Harry Rex to explore the possibility of a drink to catch up on things. At 3:30, he was done for the week and contemplating which excuse to feed Portia so he could leave without appearing shiftless. He still thought it was important to lead by example, and she was quite impressionable. However, after working there for 2 years, Portia knew his schedule and his lame excuses. She buzzed him at 3:40 and said there was someone to see him. No, the person had not made an appointment. Yes, she realized it was Friday afternoon, but it was Pastor Charles McGarry, and he told her the matter was urgent. Jake welcomed him to his office, and they sat in a corner. Charles on the old leather sofa, Jake in a chair that was at least 100 years old. The preacher declined coffee or tea and was obviously troubled. He told the story of driving Josie and Kira to Whitfield on Tuesday, leaving them there and fetching them the following day. Jake knew all this. He had spoken twice with Dr. Sadie Weaver and knew the family had spent almost 7 hours in 3 sessions. Charles said, "When we were driving down early Tuesday, Kira got sick and threw up twice. Josie said she always got car sick real easy. I didn't think much about it. When I went back to get them at Whitfield on Wednesday, one of the nurses told me that Kira had been sick that morning. Nausea, throwing up, you know. I thought it was unusual because she had not been in a car that morning. They had a room on the campus. Driving home Wednesday afternoon, she was fine. Yesterday morning, Mrs. Golden, the lady who's tutoring her at church, said she got sick again and threw up. And not for the first time. I told my wife Meg about it, and well, you know how women are usually smarter than we are. Well, Meg and I have one child, and she's due with our second in 2 months. We are so blessed and very excited. She had one of those home pregnancy tests left over from last year." Jake was nodding. He had purchased several since Hannah arrived, and the results had always been negative, to their great disappointment. Meg agreed to have a chat with Josie. Kira took the test, and it's positive. I drove them to a doctor in Tupelo this morning. She's 3 months along. Wouldn't tell the doctor or his nurse anything about the father." Jake felt like he had been mule-kicked in the gut. The preacher was on a roll. "Driving back this morning, she got sick again and threw up in my car. What a mess. Poor girl. We got her back to the church, and Josie put her to bed. She and Meg took turns sitting with her until she felt better. She had some soup for lunch, and we all just sat around in the kitchen, and she started talking, you know. She said Kofor started molesting her back around Christmas. Said he did it about 5 or 6 times, and that he threatened to kill her if she told anyone. She didn't tell Josie, and of course this near about killed her mother. A lot of tears today, Jake. Mine too. Can you imagine?"
14 years old and getting raped by a thug that she was terrified of? Too frightened to tell anyone? Not sure when it would end? She says she thought about killing herself.
Did Drew know? Jake asked. The answer could have enormous consequences.
Don't know. You need to ask her that, Jake. You need to talk to her and to Josie. They're a mess, as you might guess. I mean, think about what they've been through in the past 2 weeks. The shooting, surgery, hospitals, Drew in jail, Whitfield and back, losing everything they had, which wasn't much, but now they're living in the back of our church. And all the talk about putting Drew in the gas chamber. They're pitiful, Jake, and they really need your help. They trust you and want your advice. I'm doing the best I can, Jake, but I'm just a rookie preacher who never made it to college.
His voice cracked and his eyes watered. He looked away, shook his head, fought his emotions.
I'm sorry. It's been a long day with those two, Jake. A real long day. And they need to talk to you.
Okay. Okay.
And there's something else, Jake. Josie's first reaction was that they would get an abortion. She feels pretty strong about it, at least for now. And I'm not in favor, for obvious reasons. I'm dead set against it. Josie seems to have some strong feelings. So do I. If Kira gets an abortion, then she's out of my church.
Let's worry about that later, Charles. You said she saw a doctor in Tupelo?
Yes. Josie likes the guy who operated on her, so she called his nurse. They called someone else, and the guy did a favor and got her in. Said she's healthy and all, but she's just a kid.
And Meg knows all this?
Meg was in the room, Jake. Meg is right there with them.
Okay. It's real important to keep this as quiet as possible. My head is spinning as I try to think of all the ramifications. I know how gossip flies around in a small church.
Right, right.
Almost as fast as it flies around in a coffee shop. Jake asked, "Is she showing?"
I couldn't tell anything. I mean, I tried not to stare, but I don't think so. Why don't you come see for yourself, Jake? They're at the church waiting for you.
Kira was napping upstairs when Jake entered the rear door that opened into the kitchen. At one end of a long table was a stack of textbooks and notepads, proof that the student was getting tutored at some level. Meg and Josie were at the table, working on a large jigsaw puzzle. The McGarry's 4-year-old, Justin, was playing quietly in a corner. Josie stood and hugged Jake, as if they had been close for years. Meg went to the counter and rinsed out the coffee pot to brew a fresh one. Though the windows were up and the curtains were moving with the breeze, the room had the heavy feel and smell of a long day's drama. It took 22 minutes to drive from the Clanton Square to the Good Shepherd Bible Church, and in that short period, Jake had tried unsuccessfully to first identify all the new legal issues and then to untangle them. Assuming she was really pregnant and that Kofor was the father, how would this be presented at Drew's trial? Since she was present at the shooting, she would undoubtedly be called as a witness for the prosecution. Could her pregnancy be mentioned? What if her mother insisted on an abortion? Would the jury know about that? If Drew knew Kofor was raping his sister, wouldn't that seriously impact his defense? He killed to stop it. He killed out of retribution. Regardless of why he killed, Lowell Dyer could argue persuasively that he knew exactly what he was doing. How could they prove the child was Kofor's? What if someone else was the father? With Kira's troubled background, wasn't it possible she had started having sex early? Could there be a boyfriend somewhere? Was Jake obliged to inform Lowell Dyer that his star witness had been impregnated by the deceased? Depending on when the trial took place, would it be wise to put her on the stand when she was obviously pregnant? By proving the rapes and physical abuse, wasn't Jake, in effect, putting Stuart Kofor on trial? If Kira chose to abort, who would pay for it? If she didn't, what would happen to the child? With no home, would Kira be allowed to keep it? As he drove, he had decided that these issues required an entire team. Lawyer, minister, at least two psychiatrists, some counselors. Jake looked across the table at Josie and asked, point blank, "Did Drew know that Kofor was raping Kira?" The tears were instant, the emotions raw and barely contained.
"She won't say," Josie said, "which leads me to believe that he did. Otherwise, why wouldn't she just say no? I didn't know, but I cannot believe she would tell Drew and not me."
"And you had no clue?" She shook her head and began sobbing. Meg poured Jake some coffee in a ceramic cup stained brown from decades of use. Like everything else in the room, it appeared to be well used but clean. Josie wiped her face with a paper towel and said,
"What will this do to Drew's case?"
"It helps. It hurts. Some jurors might be sympathetic to Drew for taking matters into his own hands and protecting his sister, if that's what he was thinking. We don't know yet. The prosecutors will make much of the fact that he killed Kofor to stop him, so he knew what he was doing and can't claim insanity. I honestly can't tell you how it will play out. Keep in mind, I'm just on the case temporarily. There's a good chance Judge Noose will appoint someone else for the trial."
"You can't leave us, Jake," Josie said.
Oh, yes, I can, he thought, especially now. We'll see. In search of a subject slightly less depressing, he said, "I understand you spent time with Drew." She nodded. "And how is he doing?"
"As well as can be expected. They put him on some meds,